practice shattering myths. Dateline is Copenhagen, Denmark. This is from Fox News. The head analyst of Norway's intelligence agency says that a group of people is currently en route from Syria. Now, that would mean they're associated with the Islamic State. They're fundamentalist Muslims. To carry out an act of terror in the West, adding that Norway has been concretely named as the target. John Fitzjay Hoffman spoke in a live interview with Norwegian broadcaster TV2 on Friday, but didn't elaborate further. He was not immediately available for further comment. Here's the reality, folks, and it's why we are spending so much time covering this matter. After the United States came up with the moronic plan during the Jimmy Carter presidency with Zbigniew Brzezinski as his national security advisor to rent the fundamentalist Islamic terrorist organization known as the Taliban from the Pakistanis, arming them and controlling them and deploying them from Karachi, Pakistan, with the blessing of the Pakistanis, which Americans negotiated by providing the Pakistanis with billions of dollars worth of weapons as their price for renting the Taliban. And then in Afghanistan, where Zbigniew Brzezinski came up with this harebrained idea that it would be fun to give the Russians, at that time the Soviets, a taste of what they gave Americans when Americans stupidly engaged in a proxy war in Vietnam. So rather than America accept blame that we made a bad situation worse in Vietnam, that there was no reason for us to invade Vietnam, that was a horrible mistake, no, rather than do that, Zbigniew Brzezinski and Jimmy Carter said, no, why don't we create a similar war for the Soviets? You know, America has never gotten over this Cold War mentality. And so the United States provided $5 billion worth of weapons. The head of the Boy Scouts currently, who was head of both the CIA and the Department of Defense, Gates, was the operative at the time providing the weapons to the Taliban. And they waged war with Americans' weapons against the Soviet-backed government. Not only did we do this, but that war in Afghanistan cost the lives of 2 million Afghanis. It displaced 4 to 6 million Afghanis, made them exiles. And the United States, doing its normal duplicitous thing, Jimmy Carter refused to allow America's athletes even to go to the Moscow Games, blaming Moscow for the strife that America had instigated, that America had made possible through its weapon systems, providing, of course, the most effective weapon in that war, which was surface-to-air missiles and rocket-propelled grenades to the Taliban so that they could use them against Russian aircraft, bringing down Russian aircraft, which is ultimately what caused the Taliban to prevail over the Soviets, imposing fundamentalist Islamic rule over Afghanistan at America's direction. Well, the reason I bring up this story and I connect them to the one that I just shared with you is that after the Great Jihad, as it was called, and Afghanistan was won, and this is also the birth of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was created, called the base, by the CIA for the express purpose of recruiting jihadists to fight in the Great Jihad in Afghanistan. The base, which is what Al-Qaeda means in Arabic, was a database of Sunni jihadists from which were fundamentalist Muslims, young men, that could be recruited to play jihad and that would advance the fundamentalist Islamic quest to impose Islam on everyone the world over. At the end of that conflict, where American weapons in the hands of mujahideen, of jihadists, prevailed in Afghanistan in the sense that the Soviets were displaced, and the fundamentalist Muslims known as the Taliban imposed a vastly more cruel government on the Afghani people. That the jihadists who were foreign fighters who were recruited by the base, Al-Qaeda, to join that fight, went around the world. There was no more great jihad in Afghanistan. It was a backwards mountain country. There was no more great jihad, and they had been groomed and indoctrinated on fundamentalist Islam to fight jihad. So what did they do? They went back to Africa and perpetrated the attacks on the American embassies there. They went to Europe, and in Europe there was all of the horrid train bombings and bus bombings that killed scores of people throughout Europe. They went to Russia, where the Beslan School massacre occurred, the Moscow disaster of the Moscow theater, and so many suicide bombings in airplanes and destruction of Muslim suicide bombings of hospitals. They perpetrated hell in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, against Jewish facilities. And, of course, we know of 9/11, where these fundamentalist Muslims flew planes into the Pentagon, into the World Trade Center, and wanted to fly planes into the White House. This was the outgrowth of the Great Jihad. And since that time, Muslims now commit 99.9% of the terrorist acts around the world. Now we move forward from the aftermath of the Great Jihad and the terror that swept the world when it was over in Afghanistan, when the United States played proxy war against the Soviets, to Syria and Iraq. Syria and Iraq are not an isolated mountainous region at the fringe of the world. Syria and Iraq is in the heart of the Middle East. Syria and Iraq are not impoverished places without any natural resources. Lots of oil. Lots of money. Syria and Iraq aren't depopulated in the sense of very low population density. They're very heavily populated. And the Islamic State that America enabled by providing billions of dollars worth of arms to the Mujahideen to fight the government of Assad isn't in the league of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Now, America wants you to believe that the Islamic State is a derivative of Al-Qaeda, was a franchise of Al-Qaeda. It was never the case. And to compare the Islamic State to Al-Qaeda is like comparing a flea to the elephant that it is residing upon. Al-Qaeda is the flea. The Islamic State is the elephant. The Islamic State has been extraordinarily successful in raising capital. Now, it raises capital in the old-fashioned Islamic way, the same way Muhammad did. Muhammad never worked a day in his life. He robbed people. That's what they do. But their net worth is in the many billions of dollars now. Al-Qaeda at its peak probably had a net worth in the $20 or $30 million range. And the Islamic State is already north of $3 billion. And it's gargantuan difference. You know, 100 to 1. Also, the Al-Qaeda as a Islamic terrorist organization at its peak, which would be during the Afghan war, during Jimmy Carter's presidency, and then on through Ronald Reagan, Al-Qaeda probably had 5,000 members. Now, the number of those affiliated and working directly with, actually on the payroll of the Islamic State, is 10 times that. Al-Qaeda never controlled any territory, never sought to establish a government. The Islamic State not only controls the largest now country in the Middle East in terms of land mass, almost all of Syria and most of Iraq. But in addition to that, they're extraordinarily effective at governing. They not just control the territory, food's in the stores. Like the electrical systems work. Water is delivered. Plenty of gas for the cars and for oil for heating. The court systems work. The schools are working. They're governing the areas that they've captured. Al-Qaeda at its peak was between them and the Taliban, and most of the arms were in the hands of the Taliban. They were given $5 billion worth of American arms. About 10% of that would have been used by Al-Qaeda, and 90% of that by the Taliban. So about $500 million worth of American weaponry in the hands of the Al-Qaeda at its peak 20-some years ago. And the Islamic State received about half of the $5 billion that America sponsored for weapon systems in the fight to bring down Assad. And then they received the lion's share, the vast preponderance of the weapons that were being supplied by Saudi Arabia and Qatar into the fight to bring down the Shia government of al-Assad. Then when they became well enough equipped that they were able to trounce not only their Sunni rival in the originally larger Nusra Front, the Victory Front, they turned their attention to Iraq. And in Iraq, they were immediately able to garner the support of the Sunni awakening councils that America had armed to provide a buffer against the Shia military in that country. And all of a sudden now, the Islamic State is reprised with many members of Saddam Hussein's government, the Ba'ath Party, as well as the Iraqi military, and they're very well equipped because in their initial victories, as well as what happened today in Syria, they've confiscated billions upon billions of dollars of Syrian, Russian, and Iraqi American weapons. Today in Syria, the Islamic State captured a very large Syrian military fort. And you can see them riding around in Russian tanks, Syrian tanks, armored personnel carriers. When they conquered Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, they celebrated by riding around in A1 Abrams tanks, American tanks that had been given to the Shia government, and actually flying Apache gunships. They have anti-aircraft weapons. They have anti-tank weapons. They have surface-to-air missiles. They have tanks. They have artillery. They are, by a factor of many thousands to one, better armed than any Islamic terrorist organization in history. And so if you realize, too, that they're also the most popular. During the peak of al-Qaeda's existence, the majority of Muslims favored them, but a minority of Muslims rallied to their cause. With the Islamic State, that's not the case. They're overwhelmingly loved by Muslims, and they are extraordinarily effective recruiters, recruiting Muslims from virtually every country around the world. They have a very sophisticated propaganda arm that appeals to Muslims' desire to die. You see it, that same desire to die and to sacrifice the blood of their children amongst the Hamas supporters in Gaza. Now, the reason that I'm sharing all this with you is that whether it's under the name of the Islamic State and the caliphate under Ibrahim, or it is al-Nusra, or it is under a different Islamic banner, Sunni Muslims are going to prevail over Shia Muslims in Syria and in Iraq. And they're not going to stop there. They will go into Jordan and they will find the refugees, as they are in Jordan, particularly those masquerading as Palestinians, eager to join their ranks. And with weapons, they will not only take over Jordan, but they will head to Lebanon. And in Lebanon, they will have another war against Shias by battling Hezbollah. And then they will head to Israel. They will ultimately take Damascus. It's very possible that they engage the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in war, as well as going through the postage stamp countries, with the exception of Qatar, which is their primary weapons supplier. That's the future. Now, once they get in a mode of, you know, we've got this, and every article you read now about their administration, well, today they blew up Jonah's tomb. They have shuttered every Christian church and are using the facilities as command posts. They have completely eliminated the Christian population of Iraq and also in the areas they control of Syria. As they continue to solidify their gains, they become ever wealthier, ever better armed, ever more massive in terms of numbers through their recruiting, and ever more successful. Success will breed success, and after a while, they will begin to do precisely what the Norwegians are alerting the world to. The Islamic State is going to send out jihadists to go menace Europe and America, as well as Russia. It is inevitable. And the reason that this story is so important is that if you look at what happened after the Great Jihad, which were the tragic, I mean, the many hundreds of people dying, probably with all of the various terrorist attacks in Western Europe, over 1,000, and the thousands in the United States and the many, many thousands in Russia, and the many thousands in Africa, in the immediate aftermath of the success of the Great Jihad in Afghanistan. When you recognize that the Islamic State, in every possible metric, is between 100 times and 1,000 times bigger and more successful than the combination of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, what you're going to see in the aftermath of their continued victories is unimaginable scale of terror being perpetrated by these Muslims around the world. That is our future. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have Kirk on the line calling in from California. Kirk, is there any chance that our words, our warning, could possibly stop the carnage that's going to emerge out of Syria and Iraq over these next 15 years? Kirk, I know you're there. I'm showing that you're connected. We have a technical. Oh, there you are.
You there?
Okay. Yeah, I am. Is there anything that our words, our warning, can do that will preclude? Pardon?
Not unless somebody heeds the warning. I mean, you can only tell people this is what's going to happen, or this is where we are, and you have to respond to the words.
So you're saying that that as an individual, perhaps, someone who comes to recognize that this is inevitable may choose to rely on something other than the government that is supplying weapons to both sides.
course.
In a conflict and may choose to heed our warning and come to know Yahweh and become part of the covenant, that is not only a possibility, but the reason we're doing this. Yeah. But is there any chance that that the world at large is going to respond in a responsible way
and
preclude this from happening?
No, in mass, they'll go their own direction, and they'll just go down the little spiral.
Yeah, we are in a death spiral right now, and there is no avoiding the Magog War that's going to grow out of this war that America started in Syria and now is arming both sides in the Syrian-Iraqi conflict.
What is the justification to continue to arm these people?
Well, you know, in Syria, we got ourselves committed to this war early on when we thought we had a chance of bringing down Bashar al-Assad. And so we worked through Qatar, our CIA did, our State Department did, to provide weapons to Sunni Mujahideen. We've done it several times in Syria in the past 50 or so years. And so our CIA, which doesn't seem to have much respect for life or for values of any kind, and our State Department, which works with the CIA, decided we were going to do that, and we created a proxy war there.
Well, ostensibly, though, you're doing that to gain favor with the Sunni Arabs or Saudi Arabia, and we don't gain anything that way. I mean, at what point do you say, you know, we're not gaining anything by playing on one side against the other?
Here's the scenario that actually caused this whole thing was when America invaded Iraq on behalf of Saudi Arabia. America wanted to protect the Saudi warlords, who are the principal financiers and provocateurs of fundamentalist Islamic terrorists the world over. And the United States wanted to make certain that Saddam Hussein could not successfully control either Kuwait or Saudi Arabia. So we went to war against Iraq. And by going to war against Iraq the second time and invading Iraq, based upon a pile of lies by George Bush, what we ended up doing is giving Iraq to Iran, because we decided that democracy is something that's worth fighting for. And the one person, one vote, there's more Shia Muslims, and therefore they voted to align themselves with Iran. Now, the Saudi Arabians recognized that was a threat to their very existence. So the Saudi Arabians began negotiating with Washington to start a proxy war in Syria to rein in the Iranian Shiite influence, because when America gave Iraq to Iran, that gave Syria to Iran, and that gave Lebanon to Iran, and all of a sudden the balance of power is so out of whack in the Islamic world that the Saudi Arabians in particular panicked, and they began begging the United States to cut off the head of this monster that America had created, and they started the proxy war in Syria. And America has been drugged right along, saying, "Well, Assad, bad guy. You listen to Senator John McClown. They're killing their people, and their people have nothing to fire back. And so we need to arm the freedom fighters." Well, those freedom fighters turned out to be the Islamic State. And then when the Islamic State revealed their true nature, and now they're undeniable, and they moved across the border and unified with the American Awakening Councils and took over most of Iraq, now the United States is increasing its weapon supplies to the Iranians, which control Iraq on one side, and we're still providing weapons to the Islamic State as they battle al-Assad. So
what empire does that? I mean,
a stupid one.
I mean, and if you're doing it because you're in a hole with Saudi Arabia insofar as keeping up the petrodollar, which is part of the agreement, we'll defend you, you know, and we won't pump any gas so as long as you buy our bonds.
Right.
And is that what's going on in Russia really too? Is because Russia and China and Brazil And for that matter, I think South Africa, they pretty much are developing their own dollar exchange.
Yeah, what happened is
their own money exchange, I mean.
Yeah, this the Russian situation, and for those that are listening, the reason we talk about this is that the death of the world as we know it is inevitable, and it's on their immediate horizon. And everything that people have been told to trust, their religion, their politics, their military, these things are all now counterproductive. And so if you wake up to this reality, if what we say you can do some investigation and verify it for yourself and then choose to do what God has asked, which is to stop trusting in human institutions and to turn to Him and form a relationship with Him through the covenant, then that is why we're doing this. Okay. You mentioned Russia, Brazil, China, South Africa, other countries. It's also the International Monetary Fund. The United States has gone from the world's largest creditor, loaner of money, to the largest debtor in the world over the past 20 to 30 years. And because America is the reserve currency means that when Russia and China, for example, do business, in the past, they both did business in dollars. They would both convert their currency into dollars, and they'd make the exchange in dollars. But America has so destroyed the value of the dollar through quantitative easing and through its debt that the dollar is now an extraordinarily unreliable currency. Also, the United States, under the Obaminator, began to play Robin Hood. And began to confiscate tens of billions of dollars from banks and other financial institutions. And we're doing it all the time. We do it to say that if you don't capitulate and give us $5 billion, $10 billion, $15 billion, then we're going to pull your right to do business in the state of New York. And so countries now don't want to have to be engaged in dollars, and they don't want to use the dollar as a reserve currency because of the blackmail and the thievery America is perpetrating and the fact that the dollars are so valueless. Mm-hmm. And so what they came up with as an alternative was an international currency that could do trade between countries that did not benchmark the transaction in dollars. And China began to lead that when America started to be so belligerent against it and restrict trade with China. The Chinese said, okay, well, we can fix that. Then the United States began suing China because it controls 80% of the rare earth elements that are so essential to modern technology and to our military. And the Chinese said, I think we're going to cut back on the amount of that we're going to sell you. So America started suing China. And then we threatened China and accused China of spying on us when we're the ones that are really spying on China.
Sure.
And so the Chinese say, you know, we're going to exit T-bills. We're just going to stop buying them. And we're going to slowly divest ourselves of America. And we pushed. Russia had no interest in doing so. Russia was just fine because Russia had finally come out of the horrible Soviet communist experience and was now extraordinarily profitable because of all of the oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So Russia just said, you know, we're happy to do business with Europe. Let's just leave us alone. Well, then the United States started to play Cold War again against Russia. And so Russians joined in this international maneuver to eliminate the dollar as a reserve currency. And Republic of South Africa is part of it. Brazil is part of it. And Brazil has one of the 10 largest economies now in the world.
Sure. It's nobody in South America likes us. I mean, we've played them around forever. And
yeah, there's no one in
dictators ever. From Allende to whomever. You know, it didn't really matter.
Yeah, you can say, oh, but look at the tens of thousands of little Honduras children that are showing up here. Well, the only reason they're leaving Honduras is because of the drug war that is raging there because of America's appetite for drugs and the fact that we keep drugs being illegal. They're not trying to come here because they love America. It's because of what America's drug habit has done to their country. Yeah.
So not being shot is always better than being somewhere.
So what America is attempting to do is to go back and engage in the Cold War against now Russia and China for the express purpose of keeping them from removing the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. Now, why should that matter to Americans?
It's the only thing keeping afloat.
Because the moment the dollar is not the world's exclusive reserve currency for trading, then no one's going to hold dollars.
Yeah.
That T-bills and dollar investments are going to be immediately divested. And when that happens, you're going to go from it's going to be 4 o'clock one day on a Friday afternoon, and by 5 o'clock, your savings is worthless.
Well, that was kind of why I called.
Your economy's gone. Yeah.
What my lead-in question and to your producer was economics, and even though with the backdrop of we know whose family we belong to, we know who's going to protect us and everything,
right.
But, you know, you spend your whole life to pay off your house and be out of
correct.
Debt and have money in the bank to go through this
right.
period. They can wipe out you. I mean, I don't
yes.
exactly know what to do.
Yeah, in fact, we can talk about that when we
okay.
Hear the music playing in the background
yeah,
here. When we return, no, don't be sorry. It's a great question. Let's talk about how the end is going to be perpetrated upon us, particularly in America, between borrowing and debt and our assets. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kurt has asked a question about what's going to happen to those of us who have worked, who have saved, who have paid off their homes, who have been responsible financially. The future is really fairly easy to predict in this regard, Kirk. America as a is going to lose its status as the reserve currency with the dollar. That now is inevitable, particularly because we have pushed both China and Russia, the two leaders in this movement, into a corner, and you also have a larger economy now in the European Union than the United States. And the European Union is in favor of this same maneuver. And so that's going to happen. The moment we lose our reserve currency status, the American dollar will be worthless. Now, also along these lines is that the United States came to realize that we could no longer borrow money. And so that's what quantitative easing was all about. The myth was that it was being promoted to revitalize the economy. Well, it didn't have any effect in revitalizing the economy. It was strictly because we couldn't get anyone to buy our treasury bills without taking the interest up to about 10%. And if the interest is 10%, we're adding now $2 trillion to the debt every year just in service of the debt. So there is no way out of this problem. The problem is way too far gone, and it's a death spiral. So what's going to happen is the trial balloon was in Cyprus.
Sure.
The first move was in Cyprus when they realized that they had the opportunity to deploy the strategy, is that everybody that was on the end, the elitist, got their money out of Cyprus banks. Those who still had any savings, all savings above $100,000 was confiscated. So that was the first move. They'll confiscate savings. So if you have, now the majority of Americans don't have any savings. None. You know, the average American is about $350,000 in debt between their credit cards, their home mortgage, and their auto loans, and their student loans. They're between $300,000 and $400,000 in debt on average. So the average American has no savings. So for the vast preponderance of people, what I'm going to say will be viewed favorably. But for those Americans that actually have savings, that have paid off their home, that don't have any loans, and that have money put aside for their retirement, that money will be confiscated. There will be very much like Obama, he talked in a speech today, called it economic patriotism. And he is wants retroactively to change the rules so that a company cannot escape. A corporation can't escape U.S. taxation. We are the highest taxing taxation of corporations in the world, so corporations are moving their offices out of the United States. And so he wants not only to stop that, so that a company has no freedom. This is taxation without representation, by the way. The company has no freedom to move outside the United States, but he wants to make it retroactive. Retroactive laws is what caused the demise multiple times of Argentina. If your efforts aren't rewarded by a consistent application of laws, no one invests money, no one builds businesses, the whole economy collapses. So what Obama wants now is as economic patriotism, a retroactive law on preventing any American firm from relocating outside of the country because of our excessive corporate tax rates. Well, that's an example of what's going to happen. So what's going to happen, Kirk? You're going to have a politician just like Obama that's going to say that the fair thing to do, that economic patriotism is for the 1% who have, and probably 5%, that actually have savings, they'll be confiscated. And loans on the other side, to get the rest of the people to go along, all loans will be forgiven.
Well, I see that coming in. Down the road a little bit, but it seems like it's encroaching. It's coming look like quicker than you think. For instance, last night I was listening to a radio program, and the guy that was being interviewed said that he was leaking some International Monetary Fund documents and all, and he said they refer to us as sovereign debt. Now, we always worked on a Lex Rex government, you know, where the law is king, but that's Rex Lex,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
So if they treat us as a sovereign, then that means they can confiscate.
Yeah, Rex being law. Sovereign and Lex being law,
right.
in Latin.
Uh huh. So
yep.
They can, if they're viewing us our debt as sovereign debt, then that means the sovereign or the government can take anything just
right.
Gone with it. So
yes, and that's what's going to happen. So your savings will be confiscated. And your debts will be forgiven to get most people to go along because the money won't be worth anything. So why not do that? And when you confiscate savings, you've eliminated any potential rival. That's the future. And it's coming soon. And it's bleak. But there's an answer. I'm going to talk about that in the next hour.